We want to introduce you to our newest partner, which, like us, is Pure South Florida. That's Doral Toyota, where you can find all of your favorite Toyota models, whether you're looking for a new, used, or certified pre-owned vehicle. Doral Toyota is located at 9775 Northwest 12th Street. That's 9775 Northwest 12th Street, just a few blocks from International and Dolphin Malls. Experience the Doral difference, which means 4 years of complimentary maintenance and roadside assistance on all new vehicles. Also, in-house financing is available for credit-related issues. If you mention Five Reasons when you call 305-680-1129, that's 305-680-1129, or stop into the dealership, you work with a dedicated manager, not a salesman. Unlike other dealers, Doral Toyota prides itself on an honest and transparent buying process. That's Doral Toyota, DoralToyota.com, or stop in at 9775 Northwest 12th Street. Vamos, let's go. Welcome into the latest episode of the Five Reasons Podcast. I'm Ethan Smolnick here, as always, with Chris Whittingham. Thank you for finding us. If you're on Apple, iTunes is the best way to get us. If you're on Android, try Google Play Music. And also, you can find us on cross-platform apps, including Podbean, Stitcher, and CastBox. Recently, we've done some baseball episodes here on the Five Reasons Podcast. We did one with Craig Mish, another with Billy Gill of the Levitard Show. Both of those were very popular. You can find those for free in our library. But now we wanted to bring in somebody who was with the Marlins for 13 years through the 2017 season. Now he's moved out to the Pacific Northwest. He's calling games for just about everybody in just about everything. Some basketball, college basketball, some NBA, also some baseball on Facebook Live. And he is Rich Waltz. And the first question I have for Rich is, how has the transition gone from South Florida back to the Pacific Northwest?
Well, the biggest adjustment is me trying to download, Podbean and Stitcher and all these things. So I feel inadequate technically after I listen to that roll call. For me, the biggest adjustment is no day-to-day baseball. That's for 24 years, you had spring. It's a natural rhythm, spring training, and then you jump into the season. But there's benefits to that as well. A chance to do a lot of stuff with my family. I've got daughters who are 17 and 21. So it's been great to spend time around them. And I miss I miss the clay court tennis in South Florida. There's no clay up here in the Northwest. When I lived down in South Florida, I really liked, I really got into tennis on the clay. So, but there's other cool stuff up here. So the adjustment's not been that hard to make.
So I guess Nadal is safe now because you won't be playing that much on clay up there.
Yeah, that's right. I'm getting old, so playing on the hard courts is hard on the body. But Nadal is just dynamite on clay. So the French Open was just a cakewalk for him. So it'll be interesting to see how he does it on the grass, because obviously Federer missed the French and Federer's waiting for him on the grass. So that'll be an interesting tournament for sure.
Yeah, I can't believe how long that rivalry has been going on. It's just taken for granted at this point, because Federer was left for dead like 6 years ago, and it's still going. All right, we're going to do a little bit on everything here with Rich, and we wanted to start here with part one. Now, Rich was the play-by-play voice for the Marlins from 2005 through 2017. And I went back through those seasons because I got to be honest, Rich, a lot of them run together. There were three above 500 seasons during those. I guess it would be 13 seasons. And I just wanted to start with this question. Was there one year that you came to spring training and you thought, this is a playoff team? Obviously the Marlins have made the playoffs twice and they won the World Series both times in 97 and 03. But was there one spring training where you looked around at the players there, some of the enthusiasm, and thought, yep, this is the year I'm going to be calling playoff games with the Marlins?
Well, that's a good question, because they do run together. I think that my first season in 2005, that was a playoff team. That was still a good number of guys that were on that world championship team from 03. That was the last year of you know, Lowell and Louie and Miggy and all those guys. So that was a year that you thought they had a chance. They came up short. I think they were 2005. They were probably three or four games over 500 and missed the postseason. I think the third or fourth year after 06, probably 09, was a team that you thought now that young team in 06, of all the teams that I saw and had a chance to call games for, I think the 06 team was the one that was the most fun, because it was an absolute anonymous roster to begin the season. And as it turned out, a lot of those guys were really, really good, from Ugla to Josh Johnson to Hanley Ramirez. That team was the first team in Major League history that went 20 under and then fought their way back over 500. And they were, I think they finished just under 500. But like two or three years later, when those guys were established and they started making all-star teams and Josh Johnson was still healthy and pitching, that was a year that you thought they had a legitimate shot to either wild card or the division. And they were one of those teams that finished above 500. And they won, I think, 86 or 87 games. You know, I think, you know, the hard part about the last team that I called, the 2017 team, was you could tell it just wasn't a complete team. It just didn't have the frontline starting pitching or the depth of arms to start the season. It was a dynamic outfield and a really fun team in terms of offense. It just didn't have the arms to compete. But you know, the thing that you learn really quickly as a major league broadcaster is you have no control over what's on the field. You really can't affect whether the team's competitive. You really can't affect whether the team's exciting. The only thing you can control is your telecast. Did you have a good telecast? And there were many years, and I think this is just not me, but there's broadcasters across the landscape of Major League Baseball, the NBA, the NHL, the NFL, that, you know, have to come to the realization that your value as a broadcaster has nothing to do with the team's win-loss record. You really have to separate yourself and tell yourself, I'm going to have a great broadcast regardless of what happens today on the field. And so many a times in those spring trainings, when you had young teams that were rebuilding or reloading or however you want to say it, you went in with the idea, not so much of, boy, I hope these guys make the playoffs, or, you know, this is the year, or boy, they have no chance to win. You go into that spring training, at least I did, with how can I make the telecast fun? How can I make the telecast good? And that kind of was the plan of attack a lot of times.
How much did you think that things would change when you guys moved to the new stadium? Because I think that's the team that you didn't bring up there, was that 2012 team when they moved into the new ballpark and they made these big money signings, bringing in Reyes and Heath Bell and Mark Burley. Did you think that things would significantly change moving into the stadium?
Well, you'd hope it certainly did change in terms of your work environment, and it did change in terms of,
I've been in that booth. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and all of a sudden the stadium's located in downtown Miami and all of that. But the one thing that you, having been around the game a long time, and you see it in other places, whenever you put together a team of guys from different places with big contracts and all of that, it rarely works out the way you think it's going to work out. Because just by the nature of free agency across baseball, guys that sign for 5 years and $90 million or whatever contract they sign, the reality is those contracts are, especially in the middle to end years, players rarely are producing at that level at that time. So, you know, I think that team, think back to that team, and there were a lot of big names and a lot of big pieces, but at the same time, organizational depth is is hard to achieve for any major league team. And I think that's essentially probably what sunk that group was. They just didn't have the depth organizationally to react to injuries, to react to, a Heath Bell flaming out and not being able to perform, stuff like that. That's probably what sunk that group.
Talking to Rich Waltz here. I want to go back to the early days now, because as you mentioned, the first team that you were the voice for, that 2005 team, it did have a lot of holdovers from the 2003 team. I mean, the double play combination, Castillo and Gonzalez, Lowell at third, the whole outfield, actually, Cabrera, Pierre, and Encarnacion were all there. Conine was still on that team. I mean, and you'd added the team had added Laduca and Delgado. So, I mean, just looking at that lineup, it was a pretty decent lineup, and you had some pitching holdovers too, including Dontrell. So wanted to sort of start with sort of your memories. What comes first to mind for particular players at the beginning? And you were basically there for, I mean, Cabrera hit the home run off Clemens in the 2003 series. That was kind of his announcement to Major League Baseball. But you were there for his real breakout. And that year he hit 323, drove in 116. What are some of your Miggy memories from those first couple of seasons?
I had been around in Seattle for 10 years with the Lou Piniella years. I was the kind of the utility man for that Seattle team. And so I did pregames on TV. I filled in on play-by-play. I hosted the Lou Piniella show. So I did a lot of stuff. And I was around Edgar Martinez an awful lot. And I was a college shortstop. So I had particular interest in technique, in drills, in just, how guys got to where they are and what they did to prepare for games. And I'll tell you, being around Edgar Martinez was incredible. Just watching him go about his work, the drills that he did, the preparation, all that stuff, he made himself into the premier right-handed hitter of his era. And so from there, and Edgar, by the time 2005, Edgar's career was sunsetting, and all of a sudden I've got a front row seat to watch this young right-handed bat, and Miguel Cabrera. And there are similarities in a sense that they're just, hitting savants in terms of their skills and baseball IQ. But Miggy was much more of a natural hitter than Edgar, and so incredible that it always seemed that nothing really affected Miggy, whether it was staying out all night, whether it was, in the on deck circle chatting with fans and the umpire looking at him going, hey, come on, you're up. And he'd step in the box and hit a ball in the gap for a double. He was much more of a natural hitter than Edgar. And just having a ringside seat for that, to watch Miguel Cabrera at that point in his career, to me was just unbelievable, because it's like you're looking at this guy has the best pure hitting instinct skills that I've ever seen.
You mentioned that background in Seattle watching Edgar Martinez. If you had to pick from you mentioned the 24 years earlier that you've been around a team every day, who is the best player that you got to see on a daily basis? And for you, sort of sticks out as, this is the best player I've ever seen.
It's easy. That's Ken Griffey Jr. He was, defensively, offensively, his presence in the lineup. He was, and speed, he could steal bases. When you saw him, you could see that's the best player I've been around. Alex was there early and wasn't in Seattle long enough to see all of that, but I saw him a lot in the American League. But Griffey was the guy. Griffey was, he was everything you thought he was. He was the kid, and those were fun teams to cover with Piniella, and then Edgar and Junior and Buehner and Alex and all those guys. But Griffey was the guy. If you look at the Marlins and say who's the best player. Probably Cabrera at that stage in his career, because he could play, third base. He could play the outfield. He could play first base. He could, and he could just flat out rake.
Did you see him, Rich, as now, I mean, he's a surefire first ballot Hall of Famer. I mean, I made the case the other day that you put him in the top five athletes who ever played in Miami. If you just look at the totality of their career, I mean, I think obviously Marino, LeBron, Shaq, and Wade are in there. But I think you can make a case that Cabrera might be fifth or even ahead of Dwayne, that he might even be fourth. As meticulous as he was, as gifted as he was, did you see that? Did you think that this guy could be, you know, one of the all-time greats? And then go through your thoughts, if you can, when the trade is made and they add Maben and Miller and Badenhop and that just did you think that was a disaster at the time?
You know, I didn't think it was a disaster at the time because you knew the reality, and that was not just with the Marlins at that time, but other teams around baseball. Oakland, the Rays, other teams that were not high revenue teams, having a guy at that point in his career, you know, and in contract, that was kind of the sad reality. Look, in that 2005 season, I think he was 22 or 23 or maybe younger at that point. And you saw his resume just in that short 3-year span from 03 to 05. And you thought, if this, you know, with, like I said, the natural skills, the natural ability. The one caveat with Miggy, though, and I think everybody around him knew that, is he needed to keep his life on the rails. And he had, and certainly that was an issue in Detroit to begin with. And it feels like, and I'm not around him or around that team, but it feels like he was able to do that, thankfully. And that, I think, has helped keep his career going and keep him productive. And I was really, when I saw the news that he had ripped his bicep or ruptured the bicep, it was, I thought of that. I thought it gives you a jolt of, you know, go back and look at his career and the many years that he has and all the hits and the home runs and the RBIs and you know, the on-base percentage and all the numbers that have stacked up. And, yeah, he's headed to Cooperstown.
All right, so you talked a little about that 2006 team. And, Rich, I was actually with that team in Houston for their opener. And that was kind of a circus because that was when the Marlins were talking about trying to get a new stadium. And what I remember from that, and I wrote a very critical column that night, actually, about the team, because here you had all these young guys. You mentioned Ugla, Ramirez. I remember being in that clubhouse before the game and how nervous they all looked, even after a spring training that was fairly promising, that this was sort of their first opportunity with a totally new team. And I remember them playing that game against Houston, and I remember Marlins brass was sitting with San Antonio officials wearing, you know, big hats, basically, because at the time there were a lot of stories about the Marlins potentially moving to San Antonio. But I think it was pretty clear from the beginning that Hanley had special talent. And then you ended up covering, you know, sort of the formative years of his career. And I think Marlins fans have mixed feelings about Hanley, just incredible talent, but some moments that were a little bit frustrating, running out balls, that kind of stuff. What was the Hanley Ramirez experience like for you as a broadcaster?
It sounds like a name of a alternative rock band, right? The Hanley Ramirez experience. I think you said it quite well. Supremely talented, and at the same time, supremely frustrating to managers, to teammates, to fans. Very much an enigma type guy, but I remember that Houston series, and I remember the spring training going into that game and how anonymous everybody was. And, you know, Ugla's bio, reading it, they even in the major league bio of Dan Ugla, they butchered the pronunciation of his name in their little pronunciation guide. Which led to confusion around the league, which led to everybody calling him Ugla for the first month.
I was curious. I was curious, how would they have butchered it? I would have gone for Ugla. No. Ugla.
Yeah, it was Ugla, and Ugla or Ugla. That's what everybody was calling him. And for the first month, Tommy Hutton and I spent that month correcting everybody from PA announcers and visiting ballparks to other broadcasters. And so we had a month, a full month and a half of telling everybody his name is Dan Ugla. And it just didn't help, right? And so he went on a tear and he hit a huge home run. It was a critical home run late in the game. And I blurted out, and his name is Dan Ugla. And that kind of stuck for a few years as whenever he hit a big home run or a significant home run, that was kind of the call. But that's where that started. They were so anonymous. But, you know, Girardi did a terrific job with that team. And they turned it like mid-late season. And not just the position players, but the arms. Josh Johnson, Ricky Nolasco, Dontrell was still on that team. Aníbal Sánchez, Jason Vargas. Mike Jacobs had a for him it was a chance. That was the arrival of Cody Ross, who would be a fan favorite. So by the midpoint of that season, though, it turned into a really good story from, like you said, that first nervous night in Houston to a bunch of guys who really knew that they were fortunate to get a shot, number one, and enjoyed the heck out of life being in the major leagues, and that translated on the field.
But to get back to Ethan's question, though, the Hanley Ramirez experience, was there like a moment that you remember where, I think it was when there was like a short fly ball in a short left field and he basically kicked the ball for a triple? What do you remember about Hanley, both good and bad?
Well, good is that he could do just about anything he wanted on a baseball field. He could steal a base. He could hit a ball 425 feet for a home run. He could drive the ball, to the opposite field. He could win a batting title, which he did. You know, the hard part was, you know, the effort was in and out, and the focus, I guess is maybe a better word, was in and out. So that was, if you want to encapsulate the Hanley Ramirez experience in a few words, those are probably those words. And there was tension. You know, I remember a couple times teammates did not take to Hanley's antics or lack of focus too well, and that was somewhat of an eye opener. So that's. I mean, look, he's gone on and had put up nice numbers in other places. But I think when I think of Hanley Ramirez, I look at his career and sometimes I think about what could have been more so than where he is right now.
Yeah, you mentioned it was teammates. It was also sort of the old heads who were still around the organization. Like, I remember Andre Dawson and Tony Perez trying to work with him a little bit and trying to make their case, and that didn't go over quite so well. But again, you look at that 2006 team, and for a team that was built sort of out of nowhere, a bunch of guys had pretty good careers. You mentioned Cody Ross, who was a fan favorite. Before we move on, I've got a question about all the managers you were around, because it's pretty amazing. There were actually 9 different managers during your time, although I don't know if we count Hyde, because I think he was there for one game. But that's a lot. It's a lot of managers for you to be sort of working around and interviewing and getting information from. But one other guy, because when I polled this the other day for the 25th anniversary celebration, the guy who was named by our listeners or followers on Five Reasons Sports as their favorite Marlin ever, and I basically put 12 names on a list and we narrowed it down all the way to one, was Dontrell. And you were there for a really, really good season he had in 2005. 2006, not as good, and then he moves on in the Cabrera trade. What are your memories of Dontrell? Because to me, and this was before you got there, but I covered a bunch of his games in 2003, and I can't remember a sensation with the Marlins like that. Particularly, there was a 2-1 game against Randy Johnson, where the ballpark was full, and just everybody was caught up in sort of D-train fever. What memories do you have of Dontrell?
Just that, just the hysteria, and even before I arrived, watching from a distance, his arrival in 03 came at a great time, where all of a sudden the team really took off, and just it's one of those guys when it was a Jose Fernandez start, or back in Seattle days, a Randy Johnson start, or you know, here with Dontrell, it was a happening. It was an event. It was a Dontrell star. And not just at home when the Marlins were on the road and Dontrell was starting. There were a lot of fans. He reached through the normal Major League Baseball fans and touched, you know, sports fans, fans that liked stories. He kind of brought everybody to the ballpark and many people that didn't, you know, come to the ballpark on a regular basis. That hysteria, that excitement is the unique, not only the unique delivery, but just the personality and how bright a light he was shining at that point in his career.
A word from one of our new sponsors. That sponsor is Miss-Inc.com. That's Miss-Inc.com. They are social media problem solvers. They do social media marketing and content writing. We are using them right now. They've been in business for 10 years, and they believe in a personal, customized approach to marketing. So they only represent businesses that are serious about taking their visibility to the next level. Social media marketing requires much more than just a blog or profiles on a website like Facebook or Twitter. It takes a smart strategy and a daily interactive focus. Miss Inc. has been leveraging social media for Miami businesses since 2008. They don't believe in cookie cutter strategies or in boxing your business in with others in your industry. Here's how you check them out. Go to miss-inc.com or call 305-537-6465. And I mentioned the managers that you were around, and I'm going to go through the list here real quick, maybe to jog your memory, if maybe you've forgotten some of them, because it's pretty amazing. We talk about the Heat down here and sort of the stability that they've had, where they've had since 1994 or 1995, I guess, they've had three coaches, Riley Spoelstra and Van Gundy. This is just since 2005 when you arrived. McKeon, Girardi, Freddy Gonzalez, Edwin Rodriguez. Again, Brandon Hyde for one game. McKeon, again. Ozzie Guillen, which I might have a question for you about that. Mike Redmond, Dan Jennings coming down from the front office, and Don Mattingly. As a broadcaster, when you're trying to get to know a team, I know a lot of broadcasters sort of rely on conversations with managers and with other people in the clubhouse to kind of gather information. Do you have anything on any of those guys that you can share? Just because it's just a really wide range of personalities that you were around.
You know, it is important as a broadcaster to have a good relationship with the manager. And all of those guys I had great relationships with, because you get information that helps you on the telecast that you can use, and you get information that's helpful on the telecast that you can't use. And all of those guys were very forthcoming and open. And you have to earn that type of trust as a broadcaster. And even though guys came and went, many of those guys were in the organization or in the league that you knew from other places. Redmond is a player, Freddie from Atlanta, Jack obviously from being in the organization, Edwin as well. I don't really have any, you know, wild stories other than it was sad to see some of them go. You know, Edwin Rodriguez in particular is a really good manager and a really good baseball person, and was in a put in a really impossible spot. I remember the best moment with Edwin was when we went to, as a team, the Marlins went to Puerto Rico, and Edwin, I believe at that time, was the first Puerto Rican born major league manager. And the reception that he received when we got off the bus at the hotel was just emotional, and you could tell how much it meant to the Puerto Rican people and to Edwin at the time. I enjoyed all those guys, and I learned a little something from all of those guys too. That's part of the deal. You, when you're close to a manager or a coach in any sport, I think it's incumbent on you. And for me as an ex-athlete, I want to know things. I want to know strategy. I want to know why things went well. I want to know why things didn't go well. And all of those guys were great about it. You know, McKeon in particular was really fun to be around. First in 05, and then years later when he came back to manage the team in that one half of a season, he was everything you thought he would be. You know, he managed from the seat of his pants. He had done everything and knew everybody in baseball. He couldn't pronounce anybody's name. he was interviewing him or sitting in the dugout with him was like a 10-minute, 15-minute comedy routine on a nightly basis. He obviously worked magic in 03. He was fun, and that's, you know, I think it's important when you're around guys like that to take a little bit of something from it. As an athlete, I'm as an ex-athlete, I've always been interested, whether it's a football, basketball coach, offensive coordinator, head coach, baseball manager, hitting coach, pitching coach, of learning something, learning why things happen, learning how things happen, what went right, what went wrong, why did that happen, the strategy, the layers of decision-making process for a manager that arise in the course of a game. So I learned something from all those guys.
You take a look at some of the other managers here. You know, you mentioned Girardi was here for just the 1 year. Obviously, things worked out pretty well for him after he left, after winning manager of the year. But the one guy I wanted to ask you about, because it was just a tumultuous season, was 2012 with Ozzie Guillen. Because the team had, it was sort of a ballyhooed move that they made to bring Ozzie in. He'd obviously won a World Series with the White Sox. And then, you know, there were a lot of new players that year that people were excited about. And Ozzy just kept saying things that kept getting him in trouble. What did you experience from the Ozzie Guillen year?
You know, Ozzy was, to me and to Tommy, Ozzy was great because Ozzy was as candid a guy as you'll find. And that maybe, you know, probably didn't help him in the course of a season that went sideways pretty quickly. He was terrific. He was, you know, Ozzy was... There was nothing that scared Ozzie Guillen. He wasn't afraid of anything, anybody. And that's, you know, his personality that you saw on television or heard on radio, that was him. That's how he managed. That's how, it went. And that whole season was, it went sideways quickly. And obviously with Ozzie, the Castro comments were probably the start of it. And quite honestly, I don't think the team ever recovered from the early slide there at that point. But Ozzie, look, I like Ozzie a lot and learned a lot from him too. I like Joey Cora. Joey was, you know, kind of Ozzie's right-hand guy there. And he had a lot on his plate going on. And that may be the big, you know, one of the downfalls of that season, that there was just so much going on for Ozzie that was not necessarily on the field or between the lines, but just trying to put out fires, whether it was Heath Bell or things that Ozzie himself said. That was a year-long struggle.
We've talked a lot about, obviously, some of the fan favorites and Ugla and Dontrell and then the managers, sort of the big names from that time. Were there any characters from the time that, you know, maybe a utility infield, there was someone that you always had a fondness for, you always enjoyed dealing with?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you always – what ends up happening is if you're a – whether you work for the team as a trainer, a broadcaster, a PR person – you get to know everybody as people, and it's not, well, this guy's an all-star, so I really like him, or this guy's one of the best pitchers in the game, and I really like him. You gravitate to people that you would gravitate, whether they were bankers or lawyers or teachers or whatever. So guys that stand out, you know, John Baker was you know, left-hand hitting catcher. He now works in the Cubs front office. He was just a really fascinating guy who struggled to get to the big leagues, had to, you know, climb over a lot of mountains to get there. Really bright, really innovative. Burke Badenhop, we used to do almost a game show feature on the pregame show, Stump the Hopper, because he has a photographic memory and he could name every college mascot. And if you named a city, a minor league city, he would tell you the nickname of the team and the affiliation of that team. Cody Ross was another guy that you really liked. You know, modern day, thinking about the last few years, you kind of rooted for guys that weren't the superstars, guys that were just hanging on. And then you would meet guys that were accomplished and you know, a guy that really struck me as being bright and interesting was Dan Heron. And he's proven it, you know, the last couple of years. He's now the one of the top pitching consultants for the Arizona Diamondback. He has a really cool job with them. So those are some of the guys that you meet and you like and you root for.
On the 3 yards per carry podcast, you get this type of analysis.
Even if you count all those guys, there's only two players in the NFL that are producing 3 yards or better every time they even step on the field and run a route. And those are Julio Jones and Jakeem Grant.
And this too.
So naturally we have this dick that could set fire to a suitcase with us, okay? So
nobody's talking about your wife, right?
Join us every Thursday for 3 yards per carry on the 5 Reasons Sports Network, covering all of your Miami Dolphins news.
So we're going to move now to one of the guys that I think you're most associated with because you called so many of his home runs. So your sort of memories of Giancarlo Stanton, I guess it was Mike Stanton at first, but kind of his emergence. I remember Marlins fans started to get to know him because he was the guy the Marlins would not include in that trade for Manny Ramirez. And I think there was a little bit of buzz about Stanton because of that, when there were some calls to get Ramirez at the end of a season. And then he comes up and he starts hitting tape measure shots. And he looks like, you know, he's the guy that all the women want to be around and all the rest of that. He just had a presence to him. How did the home run calls with him develop, and what are some of your memories of Stanton and leading all the way up to last season, which obviously was kind of the culmination of all of it?
Well, the thing you learned about Stanton as a broadcaster right away was anything off his bat, you know, you judge fly balls, you judge line drives from the broadcast booth. And part of making a call, whether it's a single, a double, a fly ball out, is the anticipation or, you know, the initial call giving some sort of signal that, hey, that could be a double or that's going to be a fly ball out. The thing you learned right away with Stanton is you couldn't anticipate. You had to add about 30 to 50 feet to everything off the bat, more than your instinct told you. So a ball off his bat where your instinct would say that's going to be a fly ball out or that's going to be a line drive in the gap, it ended up being about 50. Many times it ended up being over the fence or off the wall or over somebody's head, because you just hadn't seen that type of strength, that type of exit velocity in anybody before. So it took about a month before you to make that adjustment as a play-by-play announcer, that anything off Stanton's bat is not a normal ball off a bat, and it's going to go a lot farther than you really think it's going to. He was, you know, when I think of Stanton, it's funny because people around, and even now with the Yankees, people think about just a slugger who just annihilates baseball, a one-dimensional type player. But I think of him as just a well-rounded athlete. This was a guy that was a corner and a wide receiver at you know, similar type size in high school, at a really good high school in Southern California. Was offered by Pete Carroll at USC a full ride for college football. He was a back to the basket, you know, center in high school, and he played baseball, and he didn't play in select travel teams and, you know, showcase leagues and all of that coming up. He was just a well-rounded athlete that liked baseball, liked the Dodgers growing up. So when he got to the big leagues, you could see that his routes in the outfield, his technique, you could see the athleticism, and I still see it, although you expect, and you can see a little bit of it as his career grows and he gets older, you know, especially with the Yankees, if he's going to DH a lot, that I think some of those outfield skills and such will diminish. But he was, he was a lot of fun. And I'm, you know, outside of, you know, the Ugla call, I've never been one that has a home run call that's the same. And with Stanton, I think that's a good rule to have, because none of his home runs look the same. They're, you know, his home runs deserve description rather than just, to me, than just the same old call, because they're missiles, they're, you know, mammoth high blasts. Those home runs did things to ballparks, did things in the air that you've never seen before in baseball. And you're starting to see more of it as, you know, with Judge and bigger guys and all of that. But I really felt when calling a Stanton home run, you're better off just describing it and making it unique, because everyone was unique.
Right, and that's actually my feeling on catchphrases in general, right? So, like, I'm watching the World Cup, and, you know, a lot of Spanish-language commentating, you just do goal for every goal, right? And I'm like, no, every goal is different, right? Sometimes they're a tap-in from a foot in front of the goal, and sometimes they're a 35-yard laser beam that goes into the top corner. Like, they're not all the same. So I'm with you in that regard, but I wanted to transition to Jose Fernandez, because obviously in terms of your time in broadcasting the Marlins, no doubt one of the characters that stands out the most. I guess we'll kind of start on the more kind of on the sad end, which was the feeling of devastation the morning of. And I went to one of the few Marlins games I've actually been to the last few years was that game that he played, or that the Marlins played after he passed, and D. Gordon hit the homer to lead off the game for the Marlins. Just sort of the feeling around the team and the feeling of sadness when his death initially happened.
Well, look, it was, in my professional life, it was two of the hardest days that I've ever experienced, because you got word on Sunday morning. It was a day game against the Braves. Everybody kind of got a text or saw it on television, the crawl that Jose had been killed. And there was such disbelief, and everybody raced to the ballpark. We were told that the game would not be played, but that the Marlins would have a press conference. And then I was told that we were going on the air right before the press conference to announce what had happened and then carry that press conference. And so, you know, I think you have to step back and again reiterate how everybody felt about Jose as, like your favorite brother, your little brother, whether you were a player, whether you were a front office person, whether you were an usher, whether you were a parking attendant. Jose was the guy that always said hello to you. Jose was the guy that always talked to you. He was the type of, and so that added to what obviously has a tragedy that just has layers upon layers of sadness and tragedy attached to it. So, you come on the air and you're trying to hold it together, because he used to come to the booth when he had Tommy John surgery and sit in and just look, because he was so curious. He wanted to see what television was about. He came on the air with us. And then we tossed it down to that news conference, and it just, you never seen anything like that with front office, general managers and managers and teammates just, falling apart. And then the next night, you're all of a sudden you have to do a telecast, and I can't, look, it was hard as a broadcaster, but I just can't imagine as a player how hard it was for those guys to play that game. You saw things on that Monday night on the field that you'd never seen in your life and never expected to see on the field of a sport, whether it's baseball or football or basketball. I remember that the team didn't take the field for a 7 o'clock game. They didn't come out. Guys didn't come out and start stretching or running till about 5 minutes before 7 o'clock. There was no batting practice or infield or anything. I remember we did a live open, and my producer said, I'm going to show you a shot of this and that and fans in mourning and the monument outside of the ballpark. And then we'll come in the park and I'll show you guys running and stretching. I'll show you Yelich and Stanton and Ozuna. And that's kind of your, for the open, you're expecting that and you're narrating that. And when we got to the shots of the players, you realize that, there they were running and stretching, but they were all weeping. And then at that point, you just really hit you that this is going to be hard, and this is going to be something that, you have you've never experienced and you've never seen. And you could see, I mean, there were shots of players throughout the game breaking down on the field. Not, you know, and not just Marlin players. I think there was a shot of Travis d'Arnaud, the Mets catcher, who was crying, you know, during the game. So, yeah, that was and it's I've not watched that telecast. I have not gone back and ever watched any of that telecast. And I quite honestly, I don't think I ever will. But there were so many things in that game and on that telecast that were not scripted. You know, the team did a really nice job to me of not scripting, we're going to do this and we're going to honor him this way, we're going to do this. There were just a few little simple things, and the rest of it was spontaneous. Our production group did an incredible job. We had great sound in dugouts and on the fields to begin with, and it especially was important, I think, on that night and during those moments.
And in terms of from a baseball playing point of view and just sort of how incredible he was, we talked about some of the best Marlins you've ever seen. I'm sure at the peak of his powers, if he'd sort of carried on, he would have been one of the best pitchers ever.
Yeah, look, I still get, in fact, I did a game yesterday in Seattle, the Rangers and the Mariners, and I forget who it was, but someone came up to me and asked me about Jose and said, hey, what was it like calling his games? Because I used to watch him from a different league. I used to watch all of his starts, you know, much like we talked earlier about Dontrell, who used to attract eyeballs and fans. And it was, I told him, man, it was everything that you thought it would be. The energy that he brought to the mound during those starts, the passion, the fun that he had, all of that was included in the start. And, you know, plus, he was a dominant pitcher. On top of that, he was a dominant pitcher. And so, look, there's that story and his death have, as I said, just layers of tragedy from, you know, the alcohol and the cocaine to the loss of two other lives to, you know, his family, his unborn child. So it was such a heavy, heavy thing that for anybody to get through. That it's still hard. I saw D. Gordon the other day in Seattle at a game, and you know, just the impact it's had on those players is, and most of those guys have dispersed throughout Major League Baseball. That's a lifetime thing for them, and certainly it's a lifetime thing for me.
Before we move on this, you mentioned D. Gordon. Before we did the pod, I was listening to your call on the home run. What went through your mind at that moment, and how well do you remember it?
I remember it quite well because it was early in the game, and at that point, and I was working with Al Leiter. At that point, you're just trying to keep it together and keep from breaking down. We were told that D might do something to honor Jose. And so as he came to the – you could tell he had – he didn't have his bat. He didn't have Jose's – and he, I think he had Jose's helmet. And he came to the right-handed batter's box against Cologne. So you knew that was an extraordinary moment to begin with right there. Takes a pitch, takes, you know, changes everything and flips over and then hits it out. And, you know, you call the home run, you try to reflect in your voice the gravity of it or the significance of it, of the moment. It was, I remember the crowd at that point was just, I think, looking for something to latch onto. And even though it wasn't a full house, the place just exploded. And so as D, you know, hits it and you call the home run, you realize, and there's nothing I can say that is any better than the crowd, than D running around the bases, than that moment. And so just let the moment go. And the other thing, you know, I knew that we had great sound, as I mentioned. We had great sound in the plate area, in the dugout area. And so you knew that when he was finished rounding the bases, those sounds, those pictures, that was the moment, not me. And so I just let it go. And, you know, I've seen that play. I haven't watched the telecast, but I've seen that play on highlights and stuff. And I think that was the only way to do it, was not talk over it, not ruin it, because you could hear, you know, players crying. You know, you could hear just the emotion in the dugout. And he literally, you know, he fell into somebody's arms. They led him through the dugout and down into the clubhouse. It was, that was, to me as an announcer, look, you want to make a call. But at the same point, the crowd, the sound from the fields, all of that is part of that call. And so, you know, that was my approach, was get out of the way and let the moment happen and let everything happen and watch it.
Good to right.
One of the things that Chris and I have talked about a little bit is looking for the next big star in South Florida and in South Florida sports. And it's kind of a dry time for that. You know, Dwayne Wade comes back at age 36 and he's instantly the biggest star in Miami again. And one of the things that Chris and I talked about was that if Jose had lived, that he had an opportunity to be that guy for the next, if the Marlins kept him, which was always an issue with the contract stuff, but to be that guy for the next 10 years, because he had that charisma, obviously from a performance standpoint, obviously being Cuban in this community, it was all put together there. And I'm just curious for you as an observer of this, you mentioned all the layers with Jose, and a lot of them you mentioned are personal, and of course those are the most important. But do you think if Jose lives, if that situation does not happen, that maybe the breakup of the team doesn't happen, that maybe they build with him, because maybe last year with Stanton and Yelich and Ozuna having the seasons that they had, if you had Jose as an ace on that team and you added another pitcher, that it could move forward that way? How much do you think it changed the course of the franchise?
Well, look, it's hard to, from a personal standpoint, it's hard to use the word tragedy and transaction in the same thought or sentence. So, but it's easier to do it now that you're 2-3 years removed from it. Yeah, look, I think it changes everything. I think it changed it certainly changed any moves that the team made over the next year in terms of, if you had Jose, you probably build your pitching staff differently instead of going after veterans in hope that you can recapture their, you know, you instead of going after mid-range and overpaying for mid-range starters, if you've got Jose as your anchor, you can, you know, maybe keep some of the young guys that you traded away to get, you know, to plug into the rotation the next year. And then that has a cascading effect on the next year and the next year. So, yeah, I think it changes everything. But you don't know. I mean, you don't know what moves they would not have made and what they would have made. I think they probably would have changed their approach of building that pitching staff around him rather than heaping money on guys that you keep your fingers crossed and obviously didn't work out for them. And that probably added to where the team is now.
Want to introduce you to the newest podcast on the 5 Reasons Sports Network. It is a soccer podcast. It's called Pitch Invasion. My name is Chris Whittingham. I'll be hosting it throughout the World Cup, and then we'll continue after the World Cup. But right now, we're focused on the World's Tournament. It is 32 teams battling it out for one trophy. I'll be recapping the games basically after every 2 days worth of action. So every other day, we'll be putting on a podcast, recapping all the latest action, talking about all the major storylines. We'll get some guests guests on, and we'll have a great time talking about this World Cup. It's been really fun so far, so you're going to want to check out Pitch Invasion. Subscribe on iTunes, subscribe on Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I wanted to kind of transition away from what we've been talking about and kind of talk about you from a career point of view and what baseball broadcasting is now all about. So in terms of obviously moving away from the daily experience and frankly from a personal point of view as someone who wants to get into broadcasting, like I don't think there's a more difficult job than in broadcasting, right? What we do is fairly, you know, it's light and it's fun, but in broadcasting, doing a game basically every day for 6 months, that, you know, how difficult that is. But you had mentioned to us off air that you're working for now a few tech areas, right? So you're doing the Facebook broadcast that MLB is doing, and you're doing VR for the NBA in the first round for Turner. So just sort of from your personal point of view, how either difficult or challenging or rewarding is it to just kind of take everything on board, right? Whatever comes your way, whatever way that the industry is moving or the presentation of sports and baseball in particular to the audience, how do you just kind of roll with those punches?
Well, I've been real fortunate because I've always done college football and basketball. I was a college shortstop and did not go to broadcasting school. So I learned just by doing it and played basketball and football in high school. And so those sports and hockey, I didn't play it, but I called it early in the minor leagues. Those sports helped get me where I wanted to go, as well as baseball. So, you know, I was really fortunate this college basketball season. You know, both Fox and especially CBS reached out when everything happened and said, look, we'll give, if you want to do more basketball, we'll give you more basketball. So I ended up with a ton of college basketball. And I got to, as you noted, jump into some different areas, some other doors that opened. And one of those was with Turner Sports and their virtual reality telecast. It's something that if you've watched the NBA playoffs on TNT, you saw Reggie Miller wearing the goggles once again to promote. It's really, it's for a play-by-play announcer, you're still doing play-by-play. You're still calling a game. And I did the East Regionals of the NCAA tournament and then the first round of the NBA playoffs that way. So you're still, it's still play by play. It's just on a different platform. So, you know, in terms of the technique, it's the same, but you realize it's a different platform. And that's one of the things that's happening in sports television and all of television is the distribution of it. It's still play-by-play. It's still the NBA playoffs or the NCAA tournament or Major League Baseball. What's different is just the platform it's distributed on. And if you've got kids, I've got a 17 and a 21-year-old, they're great in terms of the new technology, streaming stuff from their devices, watching it on different platforms. And what's happening with these with leagues, Major League Baseball, NFL, NBA, is they want their product distributed as it always has been, but they realize that it's not just going to be distributed on TNT or MLB or Fox Sports Florida. It's going to be distributed on Google, on Twitter, on Facebook, in virtual reality. So, you know, those opportunities were a lot of fun. The NBA was really cool because I got to jump into three different series in that first round and do games. And the Facebook stuff with Major League Baseball is a very important initiative for the league because they realize two things. One, distributing their games, they need to be as innovative and up to speed as everybody else. So this deal with Facebook is, it's a game a week, and I'll do you know, two or three games a month on that package. And you know, it's a free game. It is on Facebook. You don't have to watch the comments go by. You can swipe right and the comments disappear. But as every now and then I'll remind viewers, just be careful what app you're swiping right on. and so that's a, yeah, look, it's a, you know, the Facebook game is, you're just calling the games. You know, I've had a chance to work with some really good analysts as well on those telecasts. I worked with Oral Hershiser, Eric Burns, Mike Kruko, the great Giants announcer and former pitcher. I worked with Mark Langston yesterday, the former Angel and Mariner lefty. It's just a different platform. It's a different way to distribute the games. And for me, you know, I have the ability to actually answer the phone calls and do some of the stuff that people have asked me to do in the past that I haven't been able to do because I've been doing a game a day or a game every day for 6 months. So while I'd love to be doing a baseball team every day, the fact that some of these other opportunities have come up have been very cool.
So you did the VR game. What is, or the VR games, I should say, what is that experience like? Is there anything different? Are you sort of pointing out different things to look at with the goggles? Like, is there anything,
yeah.
Is there anything intrinsically different about the experience?
Well, the experience as a viewer is immersive in terms of if you put those VR goggles on and you're watching an NBA game or that NCAA tournament, East Regional games, it's like you're sitting right at midcourt because the goggles, the aspect ratio is squeezed even lower than in high def. So it's a long, you look to your left, you can see the coach standing in front of his bench. You look to your right, you can see the other coach standing in his bench, and it's the same side of the court as your camera and your view. That's kind of the deal. And the players look like they're jumping right into your head. So as a broadcaster and a television announcer, especially, you have to be aware of the screen. You have to be aware of the monitor because you can't look in just a standard televised sporting event. You can't talk about something that's not on the screen. You can't say, boy, look at Joe Smith. He's fallen over or he's, look at LeBron is falling out of bounds or. Because if you can't see it, it drives the viewer nuts if you're talking about something that they can't see. So with that in mind, yeah, if in the VR view, and we have that view on our monitors as you're calling the game in the arena, in that VR view, if there's something that is of particular note behind the play or around the play, or if a stat drops down from the top on the right, you do direct the viewer to, hey, if you look to your right, right now, you can see Steve Kerr is angrily, in the ear of one of the officials. Or you look at the Warriors bench right now, and they're going nuts. So yeah, you're aware of that view, but when it comes down to it, you're still calling, play by play. But with that, you have to keep in mind of what the audience is seeing at the same time.
So you it's basically the audience has the visual of everything, and everything that you can see is theoretically in play.
Yeah, you're watching it just like you call a regular game. You are watching the field and the ball, but at the same time you're watching the monitor so that you know exactly what the audience at home is seeing at the same time.
Rich, before we close here, I got to get this from you quickly. Obviously, you still stay very much in touch with Major League Baseball. It's been, in my view, kind of a strange season so far where you see a team like the Dodgers that was that close to winning a World Series last year and kind of what's happened to them from an injury perspective. Obviously, the Yankees and Astros are pretty close to as advertised. The Mariners have been great. Real quick here, do you have a World Series pick at this point?
It's hard right now, isn't it? I mean, it's... Mm-hmm. Jeez, boy, American League, you want to go with the Astros because of, that's the team that's won it last year and they're somewhat intact. A team that comes out of that National League East could easily win it. The American League East could win it. National League, that's a tough call. I've been immersed in the American League this week, and I'll go with Houston. I like Houston still. Seattle's on a really nice run, and either of the teams at the top of the East could go as well. It's really hard. I don't like doing picks like this at this point because so much changes. An injury can change a rotation, can change the fortunes of a team. But in the American League, the team that I think is still to beat is the Astros. How's that? That's a wishy-washy. around that.
Just go with the defending champion when you need something, a team that still has all that. I wonder if the Mets are going to score a run for Jacob deGrom here at some point during the season. That's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. He got like two wins over the course of 13 starts where he's allowed about six runs total. So certainly we have a lot of Mets fans in the audience. It's been a rough run for them. Rich, we really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you're not going to say it, so we'll say it. I know a lot of Marlins fans miss you dearly and are certainly curious about what you're up to these days. And hopefully this will be a chance for them to find your work, which was always excellent here. So thanks for doing it, Rich, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
I appreciate the kind words, and thanks for checking in.